Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Ohio Republican Party faces deep divisions headed into a key midterm election cycle. Far-right conservatives, led by Central Committee member Mark Bainbridge, have filed a lawsuit that claims millions of dollars have gone missing. In a letter to GOP insiders, Chairman Bob Poduchik called the plaintiffs, quote, a fifth-column element determined to destroy the Ohio Republican Party. Bainbridge said the lawsuit is about organizational and money management.
We are just trying to bring accountability and integrity and good financial reporting and governance to the Ohio Republican Party.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Happy to be here, Ann.
And Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back, Laura.
Good morning.
And Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
Okay, so these accusations, first of all, I mean, is there anything to this?
Well, you know, I did a story about a month ago where the Ohio Republican Party offices here in Columbus had been put on the lien list for the city.
As in L-I-E-N.
Yes, as in L-I-E-N. And meaning that they hadn't paid their taxes. And they hadn't paid their taxes not just by a couple of months. I mean, this had gone over about a year and a half that they hadn't paid their taxes or hadn't fully paid their taxes. And the minute I put that out there and sent something to the Republican Party for a comment, 2 hours later, the taxes were paid in full. But that's something that I would think a normal business would have checks and balances on that and would know if their taxes hadn't been paid and they wouldn't go on for a year and a half. I mean, it was a small amount that was owed. I think, I think it was around $1,500. It wasn't much.
Right.
And it's like, well, not much to the Ohio Republican Party. I guess it's a lot to an ordinary person. But, you know, but the thing is that they were able to go over and you know, take care of it right away. So the question is, how did that fall through the cracks? Yeah. I was asking that. And then you hear this coming from Mark Bainbridge, and you're wondering, what are they seeing? I don't know what they're seeing, but are there more incidents like that? That's what I'm asking.
I read through the lawsuit last week, and it was interesting that they are raising some really legitimate questions about the last time there had been an audit and some of the, as Bainbridge said in that clip, some of the protocols, for example, these, I guess, rebellious members of the Central Committee were removed from their committee assignments without proper channels.
They're also complaining about this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And so it's what's interesting to me is that the financial stuff is coming up as the justification for this, but the impetus is political, which is that Bob Poduchik has given some money to Mike DeWine's campaign. They feel that didn't go through the right channels and get the right kind of vote, and they're not for the same party governor getting supported by the party that he's the titular head of.
And by the way, though, just to be clear, these issues that they're complaining about date back to the previous chair of the party,
right,
Jane Timken.
Which is also interesting because Jane is a candidate for U.S. Senate as well. So this kind of hits on both DeWine and Timken, who, you know, Timken wouldn't necessarily be considered a centrist candidate at this point. She's very pro-Trump,
right.
But it does sort of scar or tarnish, you know, both at the same time.
You know, actually, some of these issues that Bainbridge is raising go back to 2016, which was under Matt Borges's term as chair, and there was a internal audit. They called it a scathing report. That found, like, you know, one employee was unilaterally handling the banking and reporting and auditing duties without oversight. Some employees actually signed their own paychecks, and the party has taken steps to correct a lot of those problems. And Bainbridge is a retired CPA. He has the chops to follow
it's
the money.
It's his wheelhouse, right?
Sure, yeah. But it is curious. It's hard to figure out where. If there's an ulterior motive other than just, you know, we want the party's finances to be cleared up because there is so much unrest. You know, the Ohio Republican Party, even though they've won like everything, you know, for more than a decade, it's gone through a cycle of chairman, Kevin DeWine, Matt Borges, Gene Timken, and now Bob Poduchek. So
after decades
under Bob Bennett, right?
Bob Bennett at the helm, right?
Right.
Democratic Party kind of the same way, a lot of churn. And I'm wondering if that's not something that's sort of endemic for the future. I mean, it's just, unless that's kind of oxymoron, but just, is that what it's going to look like because of the changing, I don't know, demographics of voters?
I think there is a general pushback against what some people call party bosses and party bosses deciding things for voters. I mean, we've seen a real flatness to the selection process with social media and Twitter and so forth, that people are just like, hey, here I am, I'm going to run. And it's an equalizer in one way, but in another way, a chairman like Bob Bennett did a lot to smooth things out so that they didn't have nasty, expensive primaries. And powerful party bosses do that. That's their job. Their job is to help everybody navigate their career in politics in a kind of a cyclical way that doesn't hurt anybody, but really does force people to take their turn.
Yeah, everyone gets a chance at the plate kind of a thing.
Well, also, you think about, you know, Donald Trump coming in to the Republican Party, and he was the ultimate outsider. And I think that he really kind of reset the rules for parties. And also, I think that the influence of dark money has diminished the power of the political parties because, you know, there's these outside groups that are really influencing the direction of politics.
And all this is really interesting to me because we're often also talking about the fact that we can't get away from a two-party system in this country. It's the way our hands have been dealt by history and by, you know, just the way the system's set up. And yet we're finding a weakening of those parties, too. I'm wondering what that signifies.
Well, there's definitely fractions within, or factions, not
I knew
fractions.
What you meant.
It's a Monday.
We all know what you meant.
Within each party, you know, the Democrats have the far left progressives, and you know, then more the more mainstream people. And I think there's in the Republican Party, there's kind of the old school blue chip, you know, business Republican versus the Trump Republican. And you look at something like the effort in the Ohio legislature to push through anti-vaccine mandate bills against the wishes of the Chamber of Commerce and the manufacturers, and it shows that there's a waning power of the business side of the party, I think.
I will say, though, that, I mean, there's an argument to be made that the parties were weakened under Barack Obama because he was such a huge force on his own, and he raised money directly. Mm-hmm. He didn't necessarily share with the party. He didn't go through the party apparatus to win those campaigns and to advocate for himself. And Donald Trump kind of followed that mold, right, and really just ignored the party or made it sort of a separate entity,
yeah,
or an extension of himself.
Yeah, this isn't a new phenomenon. It's been coming on.
Yeah.
And as people will say about Donald Trump, and they probably could say the same thing about Barack Obama, they didn't create this issue. They tapped into it.
Right, right. And you wonder in some areas, you know, take Delaware County, for example, when we saw those numbers come in on the election, if you look at it over a snapshot of like, you know, a few years, you can see that Delaware County, southern Delaware County in particular, has gotten bluer. And there's a lot of the old Republican guard up there. And, you know, they're not necessarily thrilled with Trump. So if there was an independent candidate who could draw both Republicans and Democrats, would they be able to win in Delaware County or mm-hmm. somewhere like that, where it's kind of a purplish kind of thing? Now, you know, we're going to have redistricting and it's not going to be as purple as it is now.
And it only really counts when it comes to statewide races,
right,
because of gerrymandering.
Right. Yeah.
At least as it
stands. In politics, things do kind of I've watched them wrap around the backside, where the very far left and the very far right eventually are not that different either. So if they get together, you know, it's sort of a libertarian, less government, get out of my life. You know, look at something like the
vaccines,
abortion rights movement versus the anti-vax, and not making me wear my mask.
I mean, yeah, they're signs at their demonstrations are almost interchangeable. But it's hard to imagine them coming together either because of those issues.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. And then, you know, I mean, what's going to happen with the abortion issue going forward? We won't know until the summer, ultimately, what the U.S. Supreme Court decides in Massey. But it's going to be monumental.
Definitely.
All right. So why do some... Let's talk a little bit about the history of the parties when it comes to endorsing candidates in a primary. The far right wants the Republican Party to in Ohio to not endorse in the gubernatorial race. Obviously, there's an incumbent who is kind of the titular head of the at least they used to be of the party. But
well, I mean, it's. As we were just talking, no endorsement was really needed in the past because they would clear the field for people. And so they didn't really have particularly competitive primaries. And now six, seven people in a field and no one wants the party to get in there. Now, they would love it if Donald Trump got in there and endorsed somebody, but they don't want the party to tip the scales.
I was going to say back in 18... In the gubernatorial race, I remember going to the Ohio Republican Party meeting in which they endorsed the DeWine Houston ticket over Mary Taylor and...
Mm-hmm. Huh, that's right.
What was the guy's name? Estruth?
Estruth.
Estruth?
The lieutenant governor pick. And I remember Mary Taylor gave a pretty bitter speech about, you know, we're here to, you know... anoint the royal family, the DeWine family. It was harsh.
Yeah, but you know when the party does endorse a candidate, it's not just saying, "Oh, I endorse that person." Then they get the money, they get the organization, they get the
they get the mailings that they show up on your doorstep on the card.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes with that.
And they show up on campaign finance reports as in kind contributions and
yeah, they
that
get
sort
to use
thing.
The it's like a U.S. Postal Service stamp of some sort that helps get them discounts on all their mailings.
But traditionally or generally, the endorsement comes after the primary. Is that the idea, or
right? I mean, in my recollection, both parties have been sort of sitting out the primary and then getting behind the winner.
Yeah,
for some time.
We are going to take a quick break, then we'll get back to it. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent with the Associated Press. Laura Bischoff, she covers politics and state government for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. And Joe Ingles, she's a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Democratic candidates are queuing up for two statewide elections in 2022, the race for governor and the open seat in the U.S. Senate. But down-ballot races for Secretary of State, Auditor, Treasurer, and Attorney General have attracted little or no interest. Still with us for our weekly reporter roundtable, Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. So, Joe Ingles, what's going on?
Well, you know, the Democratic Party, they have all these statewide offices. They really don't have anyone out there yet. And so I talked with Matt Keyes over at the party the other day, and I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, you know, the pandemic has played a role in it. And he said, basically, they've been talking to people. They expect a couple of offices, announcements for offices in the next couple of weeks. But he says childcare has been a big issue for some of these candidates because they need childcare to go campaign, and everything's been so spotty with the, you know, schools having quarantines because of COVID and all the different problems that have happened. And so he said that's really kind of held his candidates back from being able to go ahead and announce early.
Hmm. Now, they do have two candidates running for governor, Democrat Dayton Mayor Nan Crayley and Cincinnati Mayor. I'm sorry. That was really
It's
bad.
A Monday, Laura. It's a Monday.
Nan Whaley, who I've known a long time. Screwed that one up. And then John Cranley, Cincinnati Mayor.
Nan versus Cran.
And then, you know, Jennifer Bruner is running for Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. That isn't going to be an open, that will be an open seat. And on the Republican side, it's Sharon Kennedy. But yeah, you're right. Like, they don't have anybody for the down ticket races, and you know,
you should be buying. I mean, you got to be raising money, you got to be
right,
you know, pounding the pavement by way of phone at least,
right? So, you've got these two mayors, which is a good, it should be a good training ground for a governor. I'm really intrigued that we haven't seen a mayor out of Cleveland run forever. We haven't seen, for example, some years ago, Michael Coleman, mm-hmm. The mayor of Columbus at the time, ran, I guess, briefly, but he kind of isn't in the mix.
Has it been since George Voinovich that a mayor, yeah. Cleveland mayor has run?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah.
Almost 30 years.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So you would think that they would have a good, some bench from the cities, which is where the Democrats have most of the power in the state. Democratic Congress people are rare because of the gerrymandering, and so we only have four to begin with. We've got Tim Ryan running for U.S. Senate, mm-hmm. so and also redistricting, I think, is a factor because
he has. There's another Democrat running for Senate too.
Yes,
Morgan Harper.
Right, and she had run for Congress in Central Ohio last time, mm-hmm. But just in terms of the Democrats' bench, it's interesting because you know, it's got to be these new people, which is what Matt Keyes, I think, is hinting at, right? Mm-hmm. Is that they're going to be young career professional politicians, and they're having some trouble.
I guess when they talk about childcare, dare I say, we're talking about female candidates.
Well, I don't know. In this day and age, it might be male candidates
maybe.
Too. You never know.
I mean, I'm not trying to.
Well, the other thing is, too, that it's, you know, this is going to be sacrificial lambs for the most mm-hmm. part, because you've got a really powerful ticket of all incumbent Republicans, right? Yeah. And so it doesn't.
After decades.
If you're young enough, you're going to want to wait 4 years and actually run when it's legit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we were talking about Republican finances earlier. What about Democratic finances statewide? Is it just sad, or what's going on? I mean, is there anything?
I haven't checked it lately.
Yeah, I haven't either, to be quite honest. But I don't see any massive fundraising push that is raising my eyebrows. You know, it's like sometimes you'll see a lot of money, a lot of, you know, things going, and I don't see any of that right now. So, but I think it's because there are, you know, those down ticket candidates aren't there. There's a primary in the, you know, the governor's race on the Democratic side, primary in the U.S. Senate, you know. So I think, you know, a lot of people haven't found the horse they want to get behind either. So, you know, it's hard to get money if you don't have this. That's the whole thing. And that's why getting those candidates for those down ticket races is important, because you want to get them out there early, right, so they can start raising that money.
Right.
And get the name ID up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Is there any, what's the filing deadline? I mean,
I think it's February. I think it's the second. Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Wow.
So,
okay.
They have a little time.
Oh, yeah, but we. Yeah, okay. Former U.S. Rep. Jim Renacci has picked a Christian film producer, Joe Knapp, as his running mate in a bid to unseat GOP Governor Mike DeWine. What do we know about Joe Knapp? Anything?
He's from Springboro, which is a little bit south of Dayton, and he's made films having to do with abortion, anti-abortion films. You know, it seems like he got interested in politics over the COVID shutdowns ordered by Governor DeWine. It's an interesting choice by Renacci. I don't think he has, I mean, this guy doesn't have any track record in terms of fundraising or political or executive or legislative experience. So we'll see where it goes.
Right. So it's sort of an outsider narrative there, mm-hmm. just like we saw with Trump. And, you know, really, Renacci is doubling down. He's the former mayor of Wadsworth and a former congressman, and he's really kind of doubling down on running to the right of DeWine Husted, who haven't actually formally announced yet, but are assumed to be running. So it's interesting because you mentioned Morgan Harper in the Senate race. And so, you know, this mainstream Democrat, Tim Ryan, has a challenger to the left, and DeWine has a challenger now to the right in the governor's race. And so
actually, he has two challengers because there's the farmer, Joe Blystone.
Right,
and if you
right.
go out, you know, like my mom lives in Washington
County,
Courthouse,
yeah.
so
yeah.
I drive down those roads. I see Blystone signs everywhere in those rural areas. Mm-hmm. So I think he has friends in the rural areas, and he must have spent a whale of a ton of money on signs.
Because those are nice big fat signs.
Yeah. Big
yeah.
signs.
I met him at the Republican forum that I covered not long ago, and you know he's he runs as a farmer in a cowboy hat and very down to earth. He's doing a grassroots type campaign that I've heard a lot of people. I've had calls from people saying, you know, you can't discount him because mm-hmm. maybe he's speaking to that salt of the earth type traditional Ohio Republican.
Okay, but. Where does he stand politically as a Republican? To the right?
I would say he's to the right of, yeah, mm-hmm. Governor
okay.
DeWine.
Whoever thought you'd say those words. Every once in a while I have to slap myself. Okay. A dark money group is challenging Renacci's conservative credentials, the Ohio Conservative Restoration Project. It's a 501c4 nonprofit formed in the state of Delaware. Which isn't unusual necessarily. Yeah. It's called Renacci, a rhino or Republican in name only. It's bringing up his previous dissing about former President Donald Trump and emphasizes his lack of action in Congress.
We've seen this in a couple of these races. This is fascinating. We also have seen a dark money group, I think, go after J.D. Vance mm-hmm. in the same way on his lack of support for the president. And the president former president has actually said, stop that. That's going to hurt me when I come back to run in Ohio in a couple of years, because all you see is these black and white lengthy ads of attacks on Trump, which these candidates are calling hypocritical and dishonest. But at the same time, it just looks like a string of attacks on Trump that these groups are paying for.
Yeah, I think it's Club for Growth that's doing that J.D. Vance one. And I think even after the former president asked that they cease those, you know, stop putting up those ads that call me an idiot, their Club for Growth polling showed that the ads were really harming J.D. Vance, but not Donald Trump in Ohio. So they doubled down and increased the TV ad buy.
Huh. That's an interesting. They're hurting J.D. Vance.
Well, that's the intent.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. They're kind of like, what are those bombs that go off and don't hurt the buildings, but they kill everybody in them? Remember those from the Reagan? I guess I'm really old. Okay.
And, you know, it is interesting that there's these dark money groups that are, you know, so active so early in these races, even as there's this giant dark money public corruption case pending in Ohio, and it has cast a pall over it. But apparently
it hasn't.
Yeah,
I mean,
it has no traction. That's what really, it kind of surprises me.
It's not illegal.
Well, HB6 is. I mean, what happened with that? I mean, but, you know, the thing is that I always thought HB6 would be a bigger deal. I mean, you know, us as reporters, we think it's a huge deal, right? We're covering it. But when it comes down to the voter level, it just seems to make no difference at all. And I think it's because it's so confusing.
But it is a pocketbook issue. Everyday Ohioans across the board, regardless, are affected by this.
Yeah.
It may be just pennies, but it's a basic pocketbook issue.
Right. It affects electricity rates and for a wide swath.
Every ratepayer in the state.
Right. Yeah. Because that bill made sure that it wasn't just First Energy that, you know, paid or got the discounts. And so it raised people's rates. I've covered utilities for a long time, and it's really hard to get people's interest in those stories, even as fascinating as this is with, you know, a former House Speaker and a utility giants, CEOs losing their jobs and former party chairs and a suicide and everything else. It's like a, you know.
You could say biggest political corruption scandal in the history of the state till you're blue in the face, and it doesn't seem to.
Right.
Yeah. Isn't that surprising?
Yeah.
Isn't that surprising to everyone else?
I mean, may be just because of the times we live in. It's just everything's such a...
You know, when the Bureau of Workers' Compensation had those bad investments with Tom Noe...
Yeah, the CoinGate stuff.
The CoinGate stuff. And it was interesting because the Democrats translated that into, Republicans are investing in gold coins and Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
And that hit home with voters.
People
and there
understood
was a
that.
There was an overturn
People who were
of,
investing in... Beanie Babies.
Beanie Babies, right.
Yeah.
But this one, it's maybe because it has to do with utilities. But Julie's right. I mean, this is alleging a $61 million bribe. It's got some big names attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
It impacts 4.5 million ratepayers across the state. A $1.3 billion bailout to an Ohio-based Fortune 500
government.
Company.
Right.
Yeah, and plus secret consulting payments. I mean, it's
and,
got
and
it all.
And the other shoe has... I mean, there's like a whole, it's like.
Yeah, there's more out there.
Yeah. It's Imelda Marcos time when it comes to shoes dropping. But, you know, people could go through generations before it even happens. This is taking so long. They're thinking there's trial next year?
Yeah. So I think the next step, Judge Black, U.S. District Court Judge Timothy Black set February 1st is the deadline for pretrial motions in that case, and he'll probably have a status conference a few days before that. So there's no way that the trial is starting before February 1. So it looks like it'll probably be, you know, springtime at the earliest.
Well, speaking of that, the pretrial motions, John Husted, two former First Energy corporate executives have identified Lieutenant Governor John Husted, among many others, as having so-called discoverable information regarding the House Bill 6 nuclear bailout bill scandal. He fielded questions last week. What did he have to say, Laura?
Well, first off, that Husted and all these other, it's like a cast of thousands who are supposedly have discoverable information. It's in a shareholder lawsuit.
Oh, that's right. I apologize.
Not in the criminal case.
Yes.
So, you know, for this whole scandal over House Bill 6 resulted in, it's, you know, there's the Department of Justice and the FBI investigation. There's the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is doing an audit. The PUCO's got a bunch of inquiries. And separate from all that is shareholder lawsuits. And so Chuck Jones and Mike Dowling and other First Energy execs and former execs are named in these lawsuits. And they say, well, all these other people, including everybody who voted for House Bill 6, has discoverable information or information that might help them mount their defense against these lawsuits. And John Husted, the short answer is he said he knows nothing.
It was just interesting to see him personally named because we have asked the governor whether John Husted had a role. He was friends and work colleagues, I guess, with Sam Randazzo back when he was Speaker of the House and some other things. And the governor has said, no, John Husted was not the person who, you know, he was not my energy advisor. The buck stops with me. And et cetera. And so it's just was interesting to see his name. The governor's name was not there.
Right. Right. They named him, too. I mean, for some reason. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll find out. The Ohio General Assembly drew new state legislative maps that are now being challenged in the Ohio Supreme Court for violating a constitutional ban on partisan gerrymandering. The oral arguments are scheduled for this Wednesday. Mm-hmm. When I was reading a press release from, I think it was the Brennan Center, about this, one of the plaintiffs in it said the state's growing communities of color accounted for 100% of Ohio's population gains over the last decade, but that recently approved legislative maps represent everything. But is that accurate?
That I don't seems, know. That's an interesting
statistic. We're having a hard time nailing that down.
I don't know if it's accurate, but I do remember that they said that they really didn't take communities of color and use that as a factor in putting those maps together. So, I mean, right there draws in questions about whether it's maybe, according to federal guidelines, whether that's even allowed, you know, because you're okay. supposed to. So I don't know. I don't know where they're exactly going with that. But it might be true.
What are you guys expecting coming up this Wednesday with those arguments? Are any of you covering that?
Yeah, I'll be covering it. They're extending the time a little bit. So each side will get 30 minutes. I think they usually get 20. And a lot of lawyers are going to be sharing that time. I think we'll hear a little bit more later today because there's a briefing. But you know, they'll just come in and they'll make their cases. The Republicans have already hinted at and said directly that they feel it's constitutional. They feel that it met all the guidelines of issue one, which was the constitutional amendment that laid out parameters
this
for this.
This is the 2015 one.
One of the striking things to me covering that was that the there are words and terms in the constitutional amendment that were never vetted publicly during this process. There was not an open hearing where everybody argued about what does proportional mean, right. What does fair mean.
Right.
Nothing was ever decided so that both sides could move forward and agree on at least what were they asked to do?
Well, I mean, when you think about both sides, it'd be Democrats and Republicans, but even all of the Republicans weren't in the room.
Right.
When things were being decided, it was functionaries that were doing it. It
yeah.
wasn't the people that are set forth in the Constitution as supposedly sitting on this commission and drawing these maps.
Right. And I mean, the governor, Secretary of State LaRose, and Auditor Faber have put in a separate brief talking about how they were left out. I mean, they put it right in the court record. They had already told reporters that and said it publicly, but they really laid out, wow, we weren't even given a chance.
Well, what's their point with that separate brief? I'm trying to understand because the governor signed it into law.
Yeah, he signed it into law. And the thing is that really, if you think about that argument, had they voted no on that commission and said we didn't have a seat at the table, it would have had to go back and they would have had to revise it. And maybe it would have looked a little different. And maybe, you know, it wouldn't have been the same kind of split of likely, you know, mm-hmm. voters. And so I don't know. I think that's, you know, they're trying to have it both ways when they say it that way, you know, because they're telling the court, well, you know, we really didn't have that much to do with that. And they're trying to play it that way. But at the same time, you know, they don't want to go against it.
Right. And I mean, the commission was structured with them there because they don't have a vested interest.
Right.
There are also four lawmakers on there who are drawing their own lines. So those three had a unique role. And they all apparently opposed it, but didn't vote against it.
I think the person who carried the most power in the process was Senate President Matt Huffman, because he also had a hand in writing up the proposed constitutional language. I think, did he have it for legislative and congressional?
I think so.
And then I think that, you know, Bob Kupp was
House
you know,
Speaker.
House
yeah.
Speaker Bob Kupp, also from Lima, Republican from Lima. I think he was involved, but you know, he's a lame duck, and Huffman is not. So I think the power balance really kind of tips in Matt Huffman's favor.
We'll continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Laura Bischoff. She covers politics and state government for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Also with us, Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Julie, legalized sports betting has been, well, you know, we thought it was grease lightning off and on over the years. But it's been trickier. It's been sticky. It's been a sticky issue in the State General Assembly for years now. Lawmakers say they've reached a possible agreement. I heard it was Bill Seitz, Representative Bill Seitz from Cincinnati area, that was saying they got a plan, but they won't tell us what it is.
Right.
Yay, democracy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to involve, I mean, the big issue, as I understand it, I haven't covered it super closely this last round, but is that... well, should it be the lottery or should it be the casino commission who should take the lead on this, or should it be divided up? And there's just a ton of argument over that. And Seitz seemed to imply that he wanted the casino commission to review this deal, which tells me that, you know, they do have a role in it. We also saw an interesting development last week that Governor candidate Cranley had come out and said that he believed, based on, I think it was an LSC document that he found, that the lottery already has the ability to do this. So that will probably be a factor in the debate on the Democratic side, or maybe, but you know, he's got something secret coming forth.
Yeah, I haven't covered the issue. We talked about it at length last Monday.
Yeah.
And nothing has changed since then, because they haven't...
except that there's a plan, but we don't know what it is.
Right. But they said, I mean, you know, they've been saying they have a plan.
Okay. All right. So all you sports betting buffs out there still have to wait. It could be years. Joe, you recently wrote about a bill the Ohio House passed that would mandate insurers pay for better cancer screening.
Right.
In some situations, how would that work, and what's its likelihood moving forward?
Well, right now, the federal government does mandate that, you know, insurers have to pay for some breast screening. But women who have dense breast, that dense breast tissue, sometimes it's really hard to tell if there's something going on in it. And that requires extra screening, which is not paid for. And a lot of times...
It's not mandated to be paid for.
And so a lot of times women will, you know, not get that screening. And then because of that, you know, the cancer is detected later when it's harder to treat. So this has been an ongoing battle. And now this bill would make it so that they have to, you know, just like they would a mammogram, you have to cover this so that you can figure. And those screenings can be quite expensive.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the chances of it in the Senate, though? It's another mandate for insurers.
Yeah, but it does have Republican and Democratic support.
Okay.
And, of course, you know, a lot of the cancer groups are also backing it. And I think, you know, when you talk to ordinary Ohioans about cancer, they, you know, people are definitely, that's an issue that people are like, yeah, we need to be doing more. You know, that's always what you hear. So, you know, maybe there's enough support that'll get over the line.
Laura, in November, the State Teachers Retirement System of Ohio Board met And had a there was a presentation regarding a proposal that involves putting $65 billion, that's about two-thirds of the pension fund's portfolio, into the hands of a new company, QED Management LLC, that has no performance track record. I'm not really sure what to make of this. What are you learning about it?
It is a really strange situation. QED Management was started by Seth Metcalf, who served as general counsel and chief financial officer for Josh Mandel when Mandel was the state treasurer. And then I think there's another guy named J.D. Tremel who's involved in it. But otherwise, they're not saying who else is connected to this company. And according to SCRS staff and some of the other trustees, they're like, well, they don't have any track record. They don't have no assets under management. So why would we earmark two-thirds of our portfolio to this untested new idea? Mm-hmm. I guess the idea is to buy treasury bonds and then like loan them out for a fee to other investors. And Rudy Fichtenbaum, who's a new member of the STRS board, he represents retirees. He's a retired economics professor from Wright State University. He and then Wade Steen, who's on the board as the governor's appointee. He's the former Franklin County treasurer. Anyway, they've been listening to QED and talking to them, and they, even though the STRS investment staff said, this is a bad idea, it doesn't fit with us, we don't want it. And then they had this investment consultant also do due diligence on the proposal, and they said, this is a bad idea, we don't want it. And actually, the guy, Steve Nesbitt, gave like, here's my top 10 reasons why you should not do this. And he said he could go on well beyond 10 ideas or 10 reasons. But still, Fichtenbaum and Steen, and then a former board member, Bob Stein, still think that this is a really good idea, and they wanted to make a pitch to the board. So it's a three-hour meeting. I didn't go, but I read the transcript and listened to portions of it, and it was very contentious.
Why are these members so on board with this? Do they explain that?
They just think that the pension system is not getting enough return to meet the benefit obligations in the future, and that this is a new idea that should be considered. Now, they also said, well, we have a motion to like draw up an agreement so that we can go into business with QED. And then some of the other board members are like, wait, what? I thought we were just talking about an idea. Now you're talking about a business proposal. And then that motion never got, it didn't get seconded. It didn't get a vote on it. What's interesting to me is, you know, the board is, I think there's like 11 members of the board, and some of them are appointed and some of them are elected. And so the board membership is changing, and there's a lot of discontent among the retirees because mm-hmm. The cost of living allowance was eliminated in 2017 or so and haven't brought it back. And a lot of these retired teachers, they're on fixed incomes, and they're kind of like, look, we want this back. And there's a very active faction of retirees that are, you know, pushing STRS management and saying that the management is not being transparent, that it is paying too much in fees, and they're not, you know, they're ignoring ways in which to bring back the COLA. The QED proposal, like Fichtenbaum was saying, oh, we can bring back the COLA, lower retirement ages, lower investment costs, and there'd be very little risk, which, you know, other members of the board are kind of like, hey, if it sounds too good to be true, then it ain't true.
Yeah, and, you know, traditionally, I think Aristotle Hutter said that...
PERS.
Yeah, formerly on the
public
PERS.
Employees, yeah.
Yeah. And he said that the way that these public pensions are structured, though, is they're structured in a way that, you know, one loss is not going to affect the overall fund. I mean, it's not like, you know, if you lose money on the right side, there's money in the left side that you're gaining money. You know, that's the way that they try to push these, and they've got them in different, you know, they're spread out. It's a comprehensive thing. So if you start putting a lot of money in a
two-thirds,
yeah.
Can you imagine putting two-thirds of anything? By the way, it's Aristotle Hutteris of the
he
Public
used
Employee
to work
Retirement
for the
Study.
Ohio Retirement Study Council, which is over
smart
all the,
when it
yeah.
comes to
yeah,
all this
it.
Stuff. He knows a
well,
lot
he did it for
about
like 20
how
years,
it's been invested.
I mean, he's been, yeah.
Yeah. And
he's also a a dedicated listener to this show.
Oh, yes.
Hey, Aris. Okay.
I will say that in terms of diversification, it's required by state law. You can't just, like, you know, plow all your pennies into one one investment.
Yeah. It's just a strange thing to pop up and to have members of the board pushing it.
Is
there any conflict of interest? Is there any of that? Do they have a relationship with QED?
That was the board chair asked the three of them, are you representing QED? And they said no.
But that doesn't mean they don't have, we don't know. Okay. And retired teachers have not been happy with the way the pension fund is being managed. Is there reason? I mean, isn't there kind of, aren't pension funds in general kind of up against it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The also this past week, the Ohio Police and Fire Pension Fund announced that they were working with some state legislators to increase the employer contribution rate for police and firefighters to, I think, 26.5% of payroll, up from like 19.5%.
And they want to go to local governments to get it, right? They
who pays, is the police and fire departments. And this is not going to go over well with the Municipal League. And anyway, that is an indication that they, you know, are struggling financially.
And Kent Starrett with the Municipal League says one of the problems that cities are facing right now is they don't know what their own revenue is going to be because, you know, a lot of people during the pandemic, these companies decided, hey, we can save a boatload of money by letting people work from home. This is working for us.
And the question is whether they have to pay taxes.
And
then,
so if they're working, if you've got thousands of people working from home and they're not paying taxes to, for example, the city of Columbus, then that's going to affect the bottom line of these cities. So they're not going to be able to pay in like they would have.
Has that been adjudicated? I mean, is that clear that they don't have to pay taxes or is that still being...
There's a lawsuit over it.
Yes.
There's a lawsuit over it. And quite frankly, you know, when I talked with Kerry McCarthy a while back, he's with the...
Ohio Mayor's Alliance.
Thank you. Yeah. He said that really one of the issues here is that, you know, maybe you're not going to save that much if you work from home and you work in a city that's kind of got a comparable tax. So they really don't know how it's going to wash out those numbers. But, you know, not knowing what your income's going to be and what your revenue's going to be and then committing a nice chunk of it to a pension fund without that knowledge is a different, you know, that's difficult for them.
So my back of the napkin calculations is that cities, townships, et cetera, local governments contribute right now like $500 million a year in payroll toward the police and fire pension fund. And if they go up this next level, I think it's going to add like maybe another 180 to 200 million a year. So
it's proportional, though.
Correct.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And Joe's right. Like one in three office workers aren't expected to go back full time. So this income tax question is got the city's really worried.
Strange times. The Ohio Department of Health recently released new data. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to get at this real quick, Joe, on the impact of the COVID vaccines and what, you know, for Ohioans when it comes to hospitalization and deaths. And there's an interesting breakdown geographically, and that kind of translates politically too, right, Joe?
It sure does. NPR did something just over the weekend looking at it on a national basis, and it said that if you're living in a Republican area, you're far more likely to die from COVID than if you live in an area that's more blue. And it has to do, a lot of it has to do with the way people think about the virus and the vaccine. It has to do with precautions being taken by people. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into that. And at the statewide level, we're seeing that a lot of rural areas have really been battling, and a lot of people have died because of this.
Yeah, and I think that it shows that what we've all experienced, which is that the issue has been politicized. I often wonder about the pandemic 100 years ago when we see all those old black and white photos of people with their masks on and, you know, other human beings have gone through this before and it just hasn't been this deeply political.
Right. That is it for now. on our weekly reporter roundtable. Julie Carr-Smyth, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for joining us.
Always great to be here.
And Laura Bischoff, politics state government reporter for USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.